We're going to be looking in Psalm 1 this evening. Please turn with me, if you will, to Psalm 1. And let's go ahead and read the entire psalm. Then we'll go back and make some applications on it verse by verse. Psalm 1 and verse 1. How blessed, he says, is the man who does not walk in the counsel of the wicked, nor stand in the path of sinners, nor sit in the seat of scoffers. But his delight is in the law of the Lord. And in his law he meditates day and night. Verse 3. And he will be like a tree firmly planted by streams of water, which yields its fruit in its season, and its leaf does not wither. And in whatever he does, he prospers. Now verse 4, the psalmist says, the wicked are not so, but they are like chaff which the wind drives away. Therefore the wicked will not stand in the judgment, nor sinners in the assembly of the righteous. For the Lord knows the way of the righteous, but the way of the wicked will perish. In one commentary on the book of Psalms, the writer puts it very well when he introduces Psalm 1 and really introducing the entire book of Psalms, saying, the psalm chosen to open the collection roots it firmly in the whole tradition of God's revealed truth, for it is the conviction of one whose delight is in the law of the Lord. The scriptures, or those which existed at the time, were known as the law of the Lord. The word Torah. The word Torah means a code of rules. It is the instruction or knowledge that God has revealed. And what I like about that statement is that sometimes we look at the Psalms and all we see, or at least all we assume is in there, is a lot of pretty poems. And if you're looking for something kind of light and fluffy to read, just crack open the book of Psalms and you'll find something to put you to bed at night. And yet Psalm 1, the first psalm in this collection, comes right out with that left hook and says, you want to follow God? You obey His truth. There's a path of the righteous and there's a path of the wicked, and they are as different as night and day. They're as different as black and white. There are two camps, not many in between. There are those who follow God and those who do not follow God, and you had better make sure that you're in the camp of those who follow God. Now, that's not an introduction to a book of pretty fluffy poems to me. That is an introduction to a collection of poems, the heart of which is the truth of God. It reminds me actually a lot of what Jesus himself said in Matthew chapter 7. Notice what Jesus says in the Sermon on the Mount. In Matthew chapter 7, beginning in verse 13, Jesus says, enter by the narrow gate, for the gate is wide and the way is broad that leads to destruction, and many are those who enter by it. But he says in verse 14 that the gate is small and the way is narrow that leads to life, and few are those who find it. Similarly, Jesus himself goes on to say in Matthew chapter 25, in the second half of that chapter, that there are but two groups on the judgment day. One group on the right, one on the left. One are sheep and one are goats. One is saved and one is not saved. John chapter 5 corroborates this as well, as Jesus explains the judgment day in that passage. There will be some who find the judgment day to be a rather pleasant experience, the most pleasant experience in all eternity. Others will face the judgment day with dread. Another writer added this on Psalm 1. Psalm 1 depicts this idea of black and white, this idea of the righteous and the wicked being so different. Psalm 1 depicts this truth in terse, stark black and white, as if announcing, let the clarity begin. The psalm is saying to you that nothing is so crucial as your belonging to the congregation of the righteous. So let's notice Psalm 1 and verse 1 a little bit more closely now, as it says, how blessed is the man who does not walk in the counsel of the wicked, nor stand in the path of sinners, nor sit in the seat of scoffers. You know, we love the Beatitudes in the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew chapter 5 because there are lovely passages that says, how blessed are these people. Blessed is the righteous, and blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, and blessed are the meek, and blessed are the poor in spirit. And here's another Beatitude for you. Blessed is the man who does not walk in the counsel of the wicked and stand in the path of sinners and sit in the seat of scoffers. How blessed is that man. What's interesting about this is Psalm 1 verse 1 is basically saying this man is isolated from society. He's not walking with the majority of people. He's not standing with the majority of people. He's not sitting with the majority of people. He's actually on the outside looking in. He's a reject. He's an alien. He's a stranger to the vast majority of people on planet Earth. And yet, this person is indeed blessed. In a way, then, it's our uniqueness, our distinctiveness. It's the way that we stand out from a crooked and perverse world that makes us most effective as workers of God. He's countercultural. He's different from the people around him. He resists the vacuum cleaner pull of the evil of the world around him. And we have got to be the same way. You want to truly be blessed? Learn how to be different. You want to truly be blessed? Learn how to be an alien and a stranger in a foreign land. Come to accept that. Come to embrace that. Come to love that. Now notice what he says here, and there's a progression here. He does not walk in the counsel of the wicked. That's the first step, isn't it? To just be around wicked people, to just associate with them in some way, to give them an ear, to listen to what they have to say, to give them an audience. Now, you haven't planted your feet firmly, you haven't sat down, you haven't decided that you're going to be a wicked person, but just the fact that you're walking in the counsel of the wicked. Ask yourself, who's giving you counsel right now? Not literally right now, because it's me. Who's giving you counsel in your life, though? When your marriage is on the fritz, who do you go to for advice? When you're having a hard time deciding what path to take in life, a career or a college or moving to a new town, who do you talk to for advice? When you're struggling spiritually, who do you go to? When you're suffering, when you're deep in sin, who are you getting counsel from? I think sometimes if we really look at the collection of counselors that we have in our lives, we'll realize, I'm not getting counsel from the right people, that's for sure. I'm not listening to the right people. And when you walk in the counsel of the wicked, you are not a blessed person. When you're just walking in the counsel of people who are just like you, when you're walking in the counsel of people who have no more insight or wisdom or maturity than you, if all you're listening to is other teenagers, or all you're listening to is other college students, if all you're listening to is other cranky people, miserable people, if all you're listening to is other people who hate being married and hate their spouses, if all you're listening to is other people who don't like their children and wish they'd move out and leave them, if that's all you're ever listening to, if you're just listening to the counsel of the wicked and walking in their counsel, don't be surprised if your life turns out exactly like theirs. Don't be surprised. But it gets worse. Not just that you're walking in their counsel, just casually trying it out, taking some steps, going down a certain road. He says now, standing in the path of sinners, that's when you stop walking and start stroking your chin and going, these wicked people really have something to say. These sinners are really proving a good point. I was walking toward God. I was at least making some progress. Then I started walking in the counsel of the wicked. I felt what it was like to walk a mile in their shoes. And then I stopped and began to ponder life as a wicked person, life as a sinner. All progress was halted. I'm standing still now. But then it gets worse still. Not only have you walked in the counsel of the wicked, and not only have you stood in the path of the sinners, but he says you have also sat down in the seat of the scoffers. If somebody's walking, it's pretty easy to change directions. When you get momentum in something, that's what you want to have. When you're rolling a ball down a hill, rolling a snowball down a hill, when you want to move a boat that's in the water, when you get the momentum going, you can work with that. You can work with the person who's walking. It's a little harder to move the person who's standing still, but the hardest person to move is the one who has sat down in a seat. they're almost impossible to change. They're almost impossible to move. Sitting in the seat of scoffers implies a kind of belonging, a settling in to a lifestyle. It's the final stage of departure from God when you're not even on your feet spiritually anymore. You've just become so comfortable with the way of sin that you just want to sit right down in it and stay right there. Verse 2. But his delight is in the law of the Lord. I like that there's this contrary statement. How blessed is the man who does not live that way, but lives this way. And that's great about the Bible. The Bible rarely ever offers you dead-end statements. It's very rare that you find something in the Bible that just says, this is how it is and you better accept it. Almost everything in the Bible is a, this is wrong and this is bad and this is not what you ought to be doing. So let me give you an alternative. There's always something else. There's a better way to go, another option. It's not the lesser of two evils. It's why don't you find the third option that's actually not evil at all. The Bible gives you the alternative, the productive solution to your problems. It's not just don't be a sinner. It's don't be a sinner, but delight in righteousness. He fills in the blank there with something positive that you can do. His delight is in the law of the Lord. In his law, he meditates day and night. It's interesting to me, in my experience, the more people study the Bible, the less likely it is they fall off the deep end spiritually. It's the people, and I'm just going to put it starkly here, it's the people who quit coming to Bible studies that I start worrying about. When you're not coming on Sunday mornings or Wednesday nights, I start worrying. If your Bible's collecting dust on the bookshelf or tucked under the driver's seat of your car, you know, so I know where it is when I get to church again next Sunday, I start to worry about a person like that. People who are studying, people who are meditating, people who love the law of the Lord, those are the people who very, very rarely fall off the deep end spiritually. You let your studying slip and your whole spiritual life is going to slip along with it. Notice this phrase, in his law he meditates day and night. God's law gives him delight because he frequently ponders what it teaches. It's not just that he's studying. It's not just that he's reading. It's that he's meditating. When was the last time you meditated on a Bible passage? That might be kind of weird. I know in our culture we kind of tend to put people off into a special box labeled weird when they meditate. And I'm not suggesting to you that you light a candle and cross your legs in some uncomfortable fashion. I'm not suggesting that you sit on a yoga mat or something like that. But really, when was the last time you meditated on the Word of God? When was the last time that you found a passage and you really camped on it? And you read it over and over and over again and thought about what every word means, what the application is, thought about how somebody else might view it, how you might view it when you were younger, how you might view it when you get older, how your kids might see it. When was the last time you found a passage that brought pure joy to you and you just camped on it and you meditated on it and you got everything possible out of that passage that is possible to you in this stage of life? When was the last time you did that? Because the writer of Psalm 1 says that he meditates day and night. And I'd be surprised if most of us meditated on a Bible passage once a month. He says in verse 3, this person will be like a tree firmly planted by streams of water, which yields its fruit in its season, and its leaf does not wither, and whatever he does, he prospers. I think we need to understand something here. This is my belief, that if you live a godly way, I think you have removed a lot of obstacles for yourself materially. I don't believe at all that doing righteous things necessarily will result in material income. I don't think that by being a Christian you're going to magically get a better job or you're suddenly going to have more money in your bank account or something. There's not going to be some windfall that comes your way just because you become a Christian. What I will say though is that when you become a Christian, you do remove a lot of obstacles from your life. When you're a Christian and it comes time to take that drug test at work, are you really worried about passing or not passing a drug test at work? When you're a Christian, and when it comes time to be honest with your boss about something, You think your boss is going to appreciate that, at least in some way? When you're a Christian, are you ever going to have to worry about having, are you really going to have to worry about having like strange or dysfunctional inter-office relationships with people? I'll tell you what, being a Christian is not the key to being rich in this life. And people who are Christians shouldn't even want to be rich in this life based on 1 Timothy chapter 6. But when you are a Christian, you remove a lot of obstacles in your life. And I do believe that in a certain way, what he says in Psalm 1 verse 3 is true materially. That when you live by the laws of God, wherever you go in this life, you're going to do better than the unbeliever in the long run. You're not going to have lies that follow you, skeletons in your closet, regrets, broken relationships, drug problems, alcohol problems. When you're a Christian, you're going to remove a lot of obstacles. And yet, even with that being said, do you think material possessions is really what he's getting at here in Psalm 1:3? I think that we'd be remiss if we came to the conclusion that all he's talking about is that if you follow the laws of God, you're going to be a rich person. That's a pretty dim view of Psalm 1, isn't it? I rather like to think of it in terms of the spiritual treasures, which is the way Jesus saw it in his Sermon on the Mount. There are people who lay up physical treasures for themselves, treasures on earth, moth and rust destroy, and thieves break in and steal. And there are other people who lay up treasures for themselves in heaven. Spiritual treasures. Moth and rust cannot destroy those things. Thieves can never break in and take those things from you. And I think that if you follow the law of the Lord and you love what God says and you live after righteousness, you're going to prosper in a way that can't be measured in dollars and cents. You're going to be prospered in a way that can't be measured in square footage of a house. And you're going to prosper in a way that can't be measured by the title that you have at your work. You will prosper. It just might be in a way that you didn't realize. Look at some phrases here. He will be like a tree firmly planted. I love that phrase. Firmly planted. That's the phrase of consistency and staying power. He's not interested in fads or other things that just come on a whim. He's interested in eternal, timeless truths. He yields fruit in its season. This is, I think, one of my favorite passages, or favorite phrases in all of Psalm 1, by the way. The fact that he yields fruit in its season, I think, shows that the godly person is always productive. But he's productive in the right way. He's productive in all the ways that God has designed him to be productive. He's not more or less than what God wants him to be. He yields fruit in its season. Now, every season of life has fruit to be born, doesn't it? When you're a teenager, is there fruit that God expects you to bear? When you're a college student, when you're a newlywed or a new parent, when you're an empty nester, when you're a retiree, isn't there fruit that needs to be born in every season of life as God designates it? Now, the fruit might change over the years. What's expected of you might change from season to season to season. But you're always expected to produce something. He says his leaf does not wither. What that means is that there will be adversity and struggles. There will be lean times and there will be hardship. Being godly is not a promise of immunity from trials in this world. But there is a striking oath that the effects of tribulation, there is a striking way that the effects of tribulation do not impact the godly person. Your leaves don't wither. You can face the wind and you can face the trial and you can face the burning sun and you can face every hardship that comes to you. But when you see a righteous man persevere through that, and when you see a righteous person make it to the end of a struggle, that is as striking as anything else I could ever see in life. Now compared to all of this, notice what he has to say about the wicked. But the wicked are not so. They're like chaff which the wind drives away. Barnes puts it in his commentary on Psalms. He says, they are like dry and worthless chaff driven off by the wind as of no value to the farmer. It is a substance which he is anxious only to separate wholly from his grain. The idea thus suggested, therefore, is that of intrinsic worthlessness. Chaff which the wind drives away.
Think about some of the most famous people in human history and all of their accomplishments. I suppose you could throw out Alexander the Great, for example. Basically ruled the known world. He was little more than 30 years old when he died.
And he leaves a lasting legacy in terms of politics and history. Isn't it kind of weird to think, though, for as much as humanity venerates a person like Alexander the Great, in God's eyes, he was chaff driven by the wind. Think about all the great artists. You can go to the Phoenix Museum of Art if you want to and look at all the great artists. And there's some pretty impressive pieces there. I like the Museum of Art. Look at public sculptures, famous celebrities, characters in sports. It's all chaff driven by the wind. All chaff driven by the wind. The most famous people in human history are as chaff driven by the wind to God. And I think that has a real Ecclesiastes tone to it, doesn't it? Vanity of vanities, all of life is vanity. You take God out of the picture, and what are you left with? Not much. Not much. In an eternal sense, if Alexander the Great could go back and do it all again, knowing what he knows now in the afterlife, where do you think his priorities would have been? Take the story of the rich man and Lazarus. The rich man had all of his comforts, didn't he? He had a nice life, and he walked past poor old Lazarus every single day, dogs licking his sores. And you remember in the afterlife, Abraham very clearly told him, you had your comforts. You had your reward, all the stuff you wanted. You got it in your physical life. And now you're being punished because you did not place the right priority on the spiritual side of things. That rich man, knowing what he knows now in the afterlife, do you think he'd go back and do it all again? Differently? I think we're all going to discover when we face the judgment day and God asks us to give an account. Mitch Johnson, what did you do with your life? Jim Eisenhager, what did you do with your life? Rebecca, what did you do with your life? And when he asks us to give an account, I think we're all going to be pretty sheepish if the best thing we can say is, well, there was that one time I won the Indy 500. That's chaff driven by the wind. Chaff driven by the wind. Verse 5, therefore the wicked will not stand in the judgment, or sinners in the assembly of the righteous. There really is a sheepishness to the sinners on the judgment day. There's a real sorrow that they have there. An embarrassment even. They can't stand before God in the judgment day. They have nothing to stand on. Nothing to stand for. As opposed to the righteous who, according to Hebrews 10 and verse 39... are of those who do not shrink back to destruction. We're of those who have faith to the preserving of our souls. We're not scared of the judgment day. Sinners are, but we shouldn't be. We'll bring our lesson to a close with verse 6. Psalm 1 and verse 6. For the Lord knows the way of the righteous, but the way of the wicked will perish. Isn't it comforting, that phrase, the Lord knows? I like the idea that if I'm going to live a relatively unimportant life in terms of earthly importance, and let's be honest here, I'm a fairly unimportant person. I mean, I've got YouTube videos and all. But if you take away the YouTube videos and probably the 12 people who listen to the radio program on Sunday morning, joking about that, of course, I'm not an important person. I mean, I don't mean anything. There's not going to be a bronze statue of me on a hospital campus anywhere. Nobody's gonna name a building on a university campus after me. I'm not going to be in a history textbook or anything. I am a really, really unimportant person. And isn't it nice to know that the Lord knows the way of the righteous? Every day that I live, God is observing me, caring about me, loving me, taking care of me. And I could have the least important life in human history, and God will welcome me into heaven like a VIP. I find that very comforting. The Lord knows. 2 Timothy 2 verse 19, the New Testament puts it in a very similar way when Paul says to Timothy, 2 Timothy 2 verse 19, nevertheless, the firm foundation of God stands, having this seal, the Lord knows those who are His. So as we bring our lesson to a close, I'll put the question to you. The Lord knows those who are His. Are you one of His people? He knows if you're faking it. He knows if you're faking it. He knows if you haven't done what you ought to do up to this point to be saved. He knows if you're making excuses. He knows if you're putting it off. The Lord knows those who are His. Are you one of His? Psalm 1's message is as timeless as ever, as important as it could ever be. You want to be that tree firmly planted with leaves that never wither and fruit that is born in all seasons of life? Then it's time to become one of God's people. Hear the gospel message and obey it. Put so succinctly, so perfectly in Mark 16, verse 16, He who believes and is baptized shall be saved. So whatever need you might have, please come forward as we stand and sing.